So after hearing the great news that Jesus was who he had said he was and who they had hoped he was, after learning that love really does defeat death, they did the exact same thing you and I do. Nothing. Went back to the house. Now, I hope that doesn't hit your face or become an indictment, because you and I have been next to some things that were huge, and there's nothing to do after you've been next to something larger than life than to take a breath, a beat, right? It's not an indictment. But there is some irony there, which John loves to point out irony to us. All the way through the gospel, he's playing this game with us. So they hear the great news. They see him. They know it's true. Let's take some time off. Let's take a break. To be fair, they were exhausted, spent, and I imagine overwhelmed. Even though Jesus tried to prepare them and tried to tell them what was coming next, how could they really know? I mean, we've heard this story several times. How do we really prepare ourselves for when God shows up in our lives? And they still had the fear knocking on their door, a lot of fear. They still lived under the real threat that something terrible could happen to them still, soon, really at any moment. Locked in the house, they had gone. Fear knocking on the door. You know, many people today in the world, in our nation, in our town, too many people live under the immediate threat of danger, of fear. And if you don't feel a real threat today, well, it might be a real sign of your privilege, of my privilege. And this privilege of ours will blur our vision, and it will lock us away from the truth that most of the world lives under daily, moment by moment. Fear shut their mouths and maybe their eyes, and so they closed the doors to the house and to their hearts, maybe, and then they locked them. And maybe we have too. And so Jesus comes in the midst of all of that, in the midst of fear and confusion and locked hearts and poor sight and exhausted hearts. And even in our privilege, in the midst of all of that, right in the center, at the heart of all of that, where our fists are tight and our belly has a knot and our mind is swirling with what if and what now and oh, dang. Jesus comes right into the middle of all of that and says, "Peace be with you." And peace was with them and is with us now. Peace is with us. "Peace is good, Jesus, and thanks for it," they say. But what now? I mean, they're still knocking on the door. Fear is still pushing us in. They could come and get you again. We could go through this whole thing again, Jesus. And are you really leaving again? You just got back, Jesus. What now? Peace is good, but, well, we can see you. The author of John knew the trouble created by Easter. John understood more than any other gospel writer that while Easter is good, good, good news, that it is also the departure of Christ. 21 chapters in the book of John, and Jesus' public ministry ends at chapter 12. What remains is farewell, a farewell meal, farewell conversation, farewell prayer, and then 9 chapters, we finally get to the final farewell, or the last farewell that's recorded in John's gospel. The pathos in this part of the text is deep and it's real. "Let not your hearts be troubled. You believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms." Now the disciples are like children sitting on the floor playing with their toys when they notice that their mom and dad have picked up the keys and put on their jacket and they're on their way out, and they ask the same questions that our kids ask, that you and I ask. "Where are you going? Can we go with you? Oh, then who's staying with us? Who's taking care of us? Where am I going? I'm going to my Father and your Father." Can we go? Well, where I'm going, you can't go just now, but you can come later. Then who will stay with us? Well, I'll ask the Father, and he'll send the Spirit, who will be with you always. Okay, then, but what now? What are we supposed to do? Can't see that Spirit, kind of hard to hear. Can't stay locked in here anymore. You know, last Sunday, I wanted to stay locked in here. As beautiful as it was, I just wanted the thing to stretch out. Let's add a couple more hymns. We can push lunch off a little bit. Scared you, Josh. Did that scare you to add a few songs? Sorry. It was beautiful. It was profoundly meaning, and it is unrepeatable, and it is gone. Right? Now what? What do you do after Easter? Well, we went over to Kent and Carol's house, Lori's folks, where she had this great meal for us, and we hid eggs, and we found eggs, and we ate dessert, and then we ate some candy. And then when everybody was getting tired and the Dallas folks were heading back home, and Kent and Carol were kind of giving us the yawn, you know, without you seeing the yawn, I came back over here, set up for a Monday's adventure, just not unusual to do on Sunday afternoon. It's what I do a lot of times. And went home, went to sleep, got up Monday, came back to the office. What do you do after Easter, especially a big one? What do we do? Simon Peter and six others went fishing. Easter was over. The whole life with Jesus of Nazareth seemed over. It was beautiful while it lasted, wonderful to be sure, but you know, you can't squeeze a lifetime out of one moment. I'm going fishing, he says. It's what they knew. It's what they did. It's what they loved. Well, I think. And while they were doing what they loved, out there fishing, boat rocking, stinky bait, they had to squint to recognize Jesus. We this week went back to whatever it is we do in a week. But that's exactly where Jesus shows up to us, isn't it? Right in the midst of our doing. But you know, we might have to squint too, because we're not going to recognize him at first, laying in the ditch, walking by. After breakfast, Jesus fixes them breakfast. Don't you love that scene? One of my favorite scenes in the whole gospel. There he is on the shore, fixes them breakfast. After breakfast, he looks up at his friend Simon, who, I don't know if you've noticed, but John's gone to calling Peter Simon again, which is his name before he meets Jesus. I'm not sure what that means. But he looks Simon in the face, says, Simon, do you love me? He looks us in the eye and asks the same thing. Weta, Alana, Barbara, John, Jody, Ann, Kevin, do you love me? Yes, we're quick to say, right? Don't even have to think about that. Not even a breath gets between us. Of course we love you. It's why we came in this room today, God. It's why this room exists here. We love you. Don't you know we love you? I mean, you got to know we love you, don't you? Can you hear what he says to us next? Feed my lambs. Tend my sheep. Feed my sheep. And while that sounds easy, you and I know that it's not as easy as it sounds, because some of us stay lambs our whole life long. And many of us don't want to be tended. We like doing it our own way. And you can't make anyone eat. Sometimes I can't make myself eat, very rarely, but sometimes I can't even make myself eat. 50 years ago this week, Dr. Martin Luther King said that this kind of work calls for dangerous unselfishness. He used the Good Samaritan story as a way of unfolding this. Those who had not stopped to help the injured man might have been asking themselves a whole series of questions. You know, they found that traveler on a dangerous road. What was he doing there? Might he be faking injury as a trap? Those who didn't stop to help might have asked themselves, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But you know, the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan asked himself, if I don't stop and help this man, what will happen to him? What question will you be asking yourself this week? Mrs. Thompson taught fifth grade elementary. The first day of school, she told those kids the same thing she told all of her kids, and she meant it in her heart, but she says, I'll treat you fairly, I'll treat you all the same, I will not have favorites. And she meant it, but we all still fall to having favorites sometimes, don't we? Hard as we try, an affinity strikes up with someone. Well, she may have meant it, and she tried hard not to have favorites, but there was this one kid who she especially didn't include among her favorites. His name was Teddy Stollard. Teddy was a problem. Teddy was always a mess, and he had a musty smell about him, and his hair was awful, and his face had this blank expression most of the time, and his mouth hung open, and whenever he answered a question, he answered in monosyllables or grunts. Ugh. Teddy never did good work. Teddy never earned a good grade. So repulsed by this kid was she that she took kind of a perverse pleasure in marking a big red F at the top of the page. You know, she could have known different because teachers keep records, but she must not have looked in the record. Teddy's record read, first grade, Teddy shows great promise in attitude and work, but he has a poor home situation. Second grade, Teddy's becoming much too serious now. His mother's terminally ill. Third grade, Teddy's constantly despondent. His mother died this year. His father shows little interest. Fourth grade, Teddy's failing. Teddy seems to have no friends at all. Teddy may be emotionally ill. She could have known. Christmas break came, and those elementary kids did what elementary kids often do. They all brought presents. Teddy Stollard brought one too. She didn't expect that of Teddy, but he did. He'd wrapped it in this really ugly brown paperback kind of paper, paper bag, grocery store bag paper, plastered it with scotch tape. And when she opened it, she opened all the presents in front of the class. Out fell this raunchy bracelet, rhinestone, half the stones missing, and then a bottle of perfume that was already half used. The kids started laughing, but Mrs. Thompson had enough sense to quiet the class, and she took that bracelet and she put it on her wrist and she showed the class. Oh, they took the cue. And then she took some of that perfume. Oh yeah. And they all agreed it smelled lovely. Well, after class, all the kids got up and went. Everybody but Teddy, who stayed in his chair until everyone had left the room. Oh, what does this one want? She says with her head down. I don't need this now. And he comes up to the room, once it's empty, right up to her desk, and says, Mrs. Thompson, you smell just like my mom. And her bracelet looks pretty good on you, too. And then he left, went out the door. And as he left, she began crying. After the Christmas break, she came back. The elementary kids came back. But they discovered they had a new teacher. Same lady, but with a whole new vision, a whole new heart. She reached for the struggling kids, for the obnoxious kids. She reached for the slow ones. She reached mostly for little Teddy Stollard, who by the end of that year had caught up with most of his classmates and even passed a few. Several years later, she got this letter. Dear Mrs. Thompson, I'm graduating first in my class. Wanted you to be the first to know. 4 years after that, another letter. Dear Mrs. Thompson, I've just been asked to give the valedictory address at commencement. Wanted you to be the first to know. Several years after that, another letter. Dear Mrs. Thompson, I am now Theodore M. Stollard, M.D. How about that? Now, I'm getting married on July 27th. Would like for you to come and sit right where my mom would have sat. You know, my dad died this year. You're all the family I have now. And you know what? She went. And she sat right there. Because that's exactly who she had become. Once she looked past a type and saw a life, a heart, a need, a promise. Mrs. Thompson gave birth to a new kid. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. youth minister had asked Daryl to help out with the youth ministry. They had the habit of going once a month to a nursing home. It wasn't too far away, too far to walk, but not too far away. Daryl hated nursing homes. Had a bad experience when he was a kid, never going back, but he gets this call from this youth minister buddy who he likes and wants to not disappoint. Hey, Daryl, we're in a jam, man. I need you to drive the van. I know you don't like doing this. Can you drive tonight? Okay, man, I'll do it, but under one condition. I do not want to do anything once we're there. I'm just driving the van. I'm going to hang around in the back, and then I'll drive the van out of there. Deal. See ya. So he does. He drives the van. They get the kids there. The kids begin singing, and Daryl puts himself against the back wall, looking terrified, really, with his hands spread out against the back wall as they roll in the residence, and the kids are starting to sing, and they're there to sing and visit, and Daryl is there to hold up the wall, is what it looks like. And they roll in a wheelchair with a man here and a woman here, and the room's pretty full, and as they get close to the end, Daryl's starting to look. Now, what's the fastest way out of here? And he puts his hand down, and he feels these cold fingers grab his hand, and he's startled a little bit and looks down, and the man in the wheelchair has grabbed his hand. Oh, what am I going to do? They're getting ready to finish up. And sure enough, they finished up. But he kept hold of the man's hand. And the kids got done singing. They started visiting with everybody. And then the kids started disappearing. And he didn't really want to leave this guy because, well, now there's this connection here that he didn't expect. And the youth minister gives him that, hey, let's go. So he leans over and says, I'm sorry, I have to go. And then he's surprised to hear himself say, I'll be back. So the man lets go of his hand, and he starts out, and then he turns around unexpectedly, inexplicably, he says. He said, I love you. And then he walked out. Oh, I got to get out of here. This isn't good. And he goes and drives the van. He takes the kids home, and he's not the same that next week. And then he calls his youth minister buddy and says, could you put me on the list? I want to go back. And you know what? The next time they went, he went back. And the next time he went back, and he went back. 9th or 10th time, he went back. Still standing in the back of the room, he's learned the man's name is Oliver Leek. And he's standing there kind of watching all the wheelchairs roll in, waiting to see Mr. Leek. And the kids have started to sing, and the staff has stopped bringing in the people and no Mr. Leek yet. And so he goes to the desk and asks, is Mr. Leek coming in? Is he okay? She walks him down the hall to his room, and his breathing is heavy labored. Daryl's in his 40s, never seen anyone near death, but thinks this might be what it looks like. This is exactly why I don't want to do this. But he walks in and he sits down in the chair next to Mr. Leek's bed. And he puts his hand on Mr. Leek's cold hand, and he starts thinking of all the things he wants to tell Mr. Leek, but he doesn't have the words to tell Mr. Leek. And the time goes like this. What he thought was maybe 10 minutes had been an hour, and the youth minister is pounding on the door, but looking all over for you, man, we gotta go. No, I'm not ready, I gotta. So he looks over to Mr. Leek and says, I'm sorry, Mr. Leek. Oliver, I've gotta go. I love you. And Mr. Leek has been unresponsive the entire time until he says, I love you. And then he feels this tiny squeeze on his hand, and some tears start going down, and he's bolts out the door. As he goes through the door, he bumps into this young woman who's standing at the door. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you standing there. That's all right. I've been waiting for you. I've been waiting for you. Oliver Leek's my grandfather. When he started going downhill, the staff called me, and I've been with him since then. He's kind of hard to understand. They said he's unresponsive, but he talks to me some. You know he's dying. Yeah, that's was afraid of that. Well, the other night we were visiting, something odd happened. As we were visiting after dinner, he looked right at me and said, with that kind of mischievous smile, he says, would you please tell Jesus that I've gone on ahead? It caught me off guard. I said, okay, Pops. And so then it hit me what I had just said. So I turned back to him and said, no, Grandpa, you tell Jesus hello, you're going to be with him soon. You can say hi to him. And then his eyes lit up, she said. And he said, she said to him, as clearly as I'm speaking to you, he said to me, oh, darling, Jesus comes to see me every month, holds my hand, tells me he loves me. And then he fainted back, laid back down with that smile that he still kind of has on his face. Well, when he told me that, I went and told the nurses, and the nurses told me about you, coming here every month, holding my grandfather's hand, telling him that you love him. And while I'd never really imagined Jesus being as bald or as chubby as you are, I imagine Jesus is glad to be mistaken. I know my grandpa sure is. Thank you so very much. And she leans over and she kissed him on his forehead. Do you love me? Feed my sheep. What I've been doing, he said, I now ask you to do. As the Father has sent me, I now send you. Will you pray with me? We do not always recognize you, O God, in the ditch, in the nursing home, in our classroom, in the mirror. But you always recognize us. And you always greet us with more peace than we can understand and more love than we can contain. Take our hands out of our pockets and our eyes off our mirrors and teach us to follow. In your Son's strong name and in your love, please teach us to live. Amen.